maintain his power?
It's a crucial question, and I don't see how we can't take that very seriously. We have to take that seriously. He's bombed a diplomatic compound. He's done something which was clearly escalatory and a new level of provocation. Will Iran, Hezbollah maintain the kind of strategic patience that they've shown? Will there be pressure on this? There's clearly not pressure to save Palestinian civilians, but is this where there might be pressure? I think we have to take very seriously that Prime Minister Netanyahu needs this war to continue and is willing and has already gone to extreme lengths to do so. There is a protest movement in Israel, not unfortunately against the war, but to prioritize getting a deal for the hostage release. We need everyone to lean into that, which requires real leverage and a real cost for Israel for continuing on this devastating path.
Daniel Levy, we want to thank you for being with us, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'll also be in Berkeley celebrating KPFA's 75th anniversary, the first Pacifica radio station. That's Saturday night, April 6th. Go to our website at democracynow.org. That's it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of the programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's board of directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, asylum seekers in Oregon face losing their housing as soon as this week due to government support gaps.
Oregon passes a law capping the price of insulin.
And in national news, a California school tests out restricting phone usage for students to impressive results.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Asylum seekers in Portland are facing homelessness as gaps in government funding and support offer them nowhere to go. A welcome center was established by the state in 2022 near the Portland International Airport at an old Ramada hotel. By the end of last year, Oregon stopped funding the center. Since then, community organizations have kept the center afloat, but now their funding has run out, and the 20 families staying there will have nowhere to go. Some may get lucky and find host families willing to support them, but others will have to live outside. Part of the issue is a lack of work authorizations, so asylum seekers can't support themselves. Those have to be submitted 150 days after applying for asylum. Asylum seekers are also not eligible for federal aid or support for basic needs. Natalie Lerner is an organizer with Asylum Seeker Solidarity Collective. She pressed Multnomah County commissioners for support at the beginning of March. State legislature passed $2 million in funding, but those funds won't be available until contracts are sorted out. Lerner says, quote, "Between when the $2 million is released and now, we need emergency sheltering. That is what the county campaign is focused on, the gap in emergency sheltering for people before there's any state support, or even better, federal support," end quote. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson has met with the asylees and reportedly is in contact with advocacy groups.
Oregon lawmakers during the 2024 session took another step to further limit the price of insulin. Governor Tina Kotek has signed a bill into law that will cap out-of-pocket insulin prices at $35 per month. Andrea Meyer with AARP Oregon says in 2019, the legislature capped prices at $75 per month, but allowed for cost of living increases. She says the current cost cap is about $85 with this increase.
This past legislative session, the Oregon legislature updated that law, and now most Oregon residents with diabetes will see lower out-of-pocket costs for insulin next year. It is set at $35 a month, and there will be no cost of living increase.
Meyer says this new price is now set in stone. It goes into effect on January 1st, 2025. Diabetes affects a wide swath of Americans, about 38 million nationwide. It's also the eighth leading cause of death. Meyer says access to insulin impacts how people treat the disease.
For far too many Oregonians, high prices of insulin have forced them to ration their insulin or even go without, which can lead to deadly consequences. So reducing this drug to no more than $35 a month will make this life-saving drug more affordable and accessible to most Oregonians.
26 states and Washington, D.C. have capped insulin prices.
Governor Tina Kotek has signed a House bill into law rolling back key aspects of Measure 110. HB 4002 expands funding for substance abuse treatment. It also recriminalizes the possession of small amounts of federal Class 1 drugs like cocaine, fentanyl, and methamphetamine. Under Measure 110, personal use possession of such drugs was only punishable by a ticket and a maximum fine of $100. Now, the consequences of being caught in possession are murky. Lawmakers and the governor hope HB 4002 will facilitate more people accessing treatment. The bill allows drug users to avoid jail time by, quote-unquote, deflecting into treatment programs. The bill, however, lets each county decide how to criminalize drug possession. This is a compromise by state lawmakers to law enforcement for their support. So far, only 23 of 36 Oregon counties have agreed to a deflection program. Sandy Chung is the executive director of the ACLU of Oregon and opposes the new law. Speaking with OPB, Chung said, quote, "It's not enough to write the word deflection in a bill. You actually have to create the apparatus, and they do not create the apparatus or fund it. We'll see whether the counties actually succeed in creating these programs," end quote. The Oregon Criminal Justice Commission predicts the bill will disproportionately affect Black Oregonians. Now that HB 4002 is signed into law, misdemeanor charges for drug possession will go into effect on September 1st.
A school in California has experimented with making students put their phones away during class. So far, they found that many students have shown greater socialization and higher achievement. Mark Richardson in San Diego has more.
Separating high school students from their cell phones might be seen as a daunting task, but one California school says having students stash them during the school day has brought some surprising results. Administrators at High Tech High in San Diego say fostering a phone-free school environment has brought surprising results. Starting this school year, High Tech High required students to relinquish their phones at the beginning of the day. School compliance officer Colleen Green says tracking student perceptions and observing the impact of cell phones on the learning culture provides a compelling case study.
Where before they were sitting in those spaces and kind of heads down into their technology, they're now sitting in those spaces and having conversations. There's a lot more engagement and conversation in class because students are talking to each other and they're not listening to their AirPods.
Across the country, more than three-quarters of K through 12 public schools prohibit non-academic cell phone use, according to a report from the 2021-2022 school year. But only 43% of high schools have such a rule, and it is often not enforced. Doug Keller with the nonprofit organization Youth Truth says it's been tracking students' experiences over the past decade in such areas as engagement, relationships, culture, academic challenges, and their overall sense of belonging. He says once the phones were gone from classes, the majority of students showed improvement in several areas.
When they implemented the policy, we saw a sharp jump upward. We saw growth, students feeling a stronger sense of belonging at their school because of this new policy, after seeing a decline that matched the decline that we have anecdotally seen elsewhere.
Keller says Youth Truth surveyed students to measure the intersection of student voice, school improvement, and key indicators of the student experience. This also includes areas like peer collaboration and relationships with their teachers. He says they will continue the study in the future. For California News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Dairy cattle herds in at least five states, including Idaho, have tested positive for a strain of bird flu. No such cases have yet been reported in Oregon. On Monday in Texas, one person was diagnosed with bird flu after being in contact with cows presumed to be infected. This is the first incident in the world of a human catching this virus from a mammal. Calmaine Foods, the largest producer of fresh eggs in the United States, said yesterday it had temporarily halted production at a plant in the Texas Panhandle after bird flu was found in chickens. Around 2 million birds were destroyed out of a total flock of nearly 50 million. Company officials said the virus had also been detected at a poultry facility in Michigan. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, eggs that are properly handled and cooked are safe to eat. The same bird flu strain has affected over 80 million poultry birds across the U.S. since 2022, including nearly 800,000 commercial chickens in Oregon.
Now, over in Texas, the cattle industry and health officials are on alert after a person contracted avian flu while working around infected cattle in the Texas Panhandle. According to the Department of State Health Services, the patient was diagnosed with bird flu after experiencing eye inflammation. The CDC confirmed the diagnosis. Health Department Chief Epidemiologist Dr. Varun Chetty says symptoms of the avian flu can range from mild to severe.
Severe illness in humans in history has included severe outcomes like pneumonia and even death. In this case, this individual presented really just with eye irritation, something that we call conjunctivitis, which is, it's not typical for the seasonal flu.
Shetty says the person is being treated with antibiotics and is doing well. Health officials say it's very rare for the avian flu to spread between humans, and the risk to the general public is low. Workers in the cattle industry have been told to wear goggles and other protective gear while working with sick animals. Shetty says the health department is working closely with other agencies to protect the public and ensure the outbreak doesn't impact dairy products.
Pasteurized milk products that you buy in the stores are safe to consume. There's a rigorous process to make sure that the milk that is sold in stores goes through the steps necessary to make it safe.
This is the second case of bird flu reported in humans in the U.S. A Colorado man contracted the virus in 2022 after being exposed to infected poultry.
In international news, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake shook Taiwan yesterday, the strongest in 25 years. Nine are dead and over 1,000 injured. The earthquake also caused extensive building damage, power outages, and mudslides. Nearly 1,000 tourists and staff were stuck on the mountains of Taroko National Park, where three hikers were killed by falling rocks. 71 workers are still trapped in two coal mines, and people in vehicles were stuck in a collapsed tunnel. The earthquake struck near Hualien, a city on the island's east coast, popular with tourists. There were over 200 aftershocks and tsunami warnings for the Philippines, China, and Japan.
Officials react to death of aid workers in Israeli airstrike. The Minnesota Supreme Court hears a voting law challenge, and lesser-known Democratic candidates discuss the presidential race. With more on the story, it's Edwin G. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This incident is emblematic of a larger problem and evidence of why distribution of aid in Gaza has been so challenging.
White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby says he's one of many outraged when 7 World Central Kitchen workers were killed by an Israeli airstrike. More than 200 aid workers have been killed since the Gaza war began last October, an unusually high number. World Kitchen says its workers were in 3 separate vehicles. Each was hit separately in spite of being clearly marked on the roof. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. will press Israel for an impartial investigation.
As we have throughout this conflict, we've impressed upon the Israelis the absolute imperative of doing more to protect innocent civilian lives, be they Palestinian children, women and men, or be they aid workers.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insists the strike was a regrettable mistake. World Kitchen is pausing aid efforts even as famine in Gaza has killed dozens. Estimates say about a third of the food is getting in compared to pre-war levels. Netanyahu also faces a domestic political crisis. Police there say a third day of mass demonstrations against his government turned violent when hundreds of rioters tried to break through barriers protecting his home. Meanwhile, Minnesota Supreme Court is considering a challenge to laws restoring voting rights to the formerly incarcerated. In their suit, the Minnesota Voters Alliance says the new laws violate a state constitution bar on voting by people with felony convictions unless they've regained their full civil rights. James Dickey, MVA's attorney, argues federal precedents show civil rights are bigger than just voting rights.
Every federal case, including decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court interpreting the phrase civil rights in the context of restoration, holds that it refers to a body of rights, and at very least the right to vote, hold office, and serve on a jury.
Several states held presidential primaries yesterday, even though the nominations are already decided. Democratic challenger Marianne Williamson had suspended her campaign but says she reactivated it after gaining traction. She says Democrats need to reevaluate the race, which they can only win through their traditional support of working-class Americans.
The Democrats are not going to win in 2024 by scolding people or shaming people who don't agree with everything they're saying. And they're not going to win just by scaring people about Donald Trump.
Harvard professor Cornel West says he's running in part because today's politicians don't maintain the values that civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. stood for.
Politics has become just legalized corruption and normalized bribery, where people will say anything to stay in office, and there's no genuine concern for people, let alone poor people, working people.
Long-shot legislation in Congress could limit former President Donald Trump's ability to use government files. The GUARD Act would restrict access for government officials who've been charged or convicted of obstructing an official proceeding or unlawful retention of national defense information. Trump is awaiting trial on 38 counts of mishandling classified documents. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jerry Chrisman and Brendan Jones from Tesla City Stories, celebrating their 10th anniversary this Friday. Then we'll be speaking with Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden about his latest article. It's called Uncomfortable Enough, Grants Pass v. Johnson. At 6, it's Exploration with Michio Kaku. Then at 7, the global sale with TK Kapura. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 43. Tomorrow, we'll see some rain showers and a high of 50. Today in history, in 1989, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the jurisdictional rights of tribal courts under the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978 in the case Mississippi Choctaw Band versus Holyfield. It has strongly influenced family law involving Indian children, helping to keep them connected to their family and culture. And our quote of the day is from American essayist Washington Irving, born this day in 1783. Irving said, quote, "There is a healthful heartiness about real dignity that never dreads contact and communion with others, however humble. It is only spurious pride that is morbid and sensitive and shrinks from every touch."
Federal funds are going towards behavioral health in rural Alaska schools. That translates into school nurses and behavioral health consultants at schools that don't have them. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Central Foundation of Alaska is using federal grant funds to place a school nurse and behavioral health consultants at three rural schools that do not have them. It's partly in response to high rates of suicide, especially for youth. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
McGrath, Nikolai, and Takotna will now share a school nurse. Those are small communities in the Yukon-Koyukuk area in the interior of Alaska. They'll also now have behavioral health consultants. Donna Acey is a manager for South Central Foundation.
Some of the things we would like to address that have been brought to us, not only by the school, but maybe the administrators and staff, would be reducing barriers and accessing care. We're trying to meet some of those high suicide rates with some behavioral health services and just support the overall well-being of the student in the community.
Acey says the nurse will be based in McGrath, and they'll visit schools in Nikolai and Takotna quarterly or more often as needed. She says the nurse can provide basic care and referrals, and she says having a nurse in schools can help kids get care without their guardian needing to travel or take time off work. Danny Kapinski oversees South Central's rural behavioral health team. She says the behavioral health consultants will visit schools in person at least quarterly. They'll also be able to schedule telehealth appointments with students in between visits. She says the consultants can also run workshops at schools that help with mental illness prevention.
Teaching students at a young age to understand what their emotions are really helps them to then be able to identify as they're growing, you know, how they're managing, what's going on for them. They might be more willing to talk about what's going on since they have the words to use and know how to express themselves.
She says that can help reduce substance abuse and suicidal ideation later on. And she says it can keep kids in the classroom more, which helps with academic success. South Central Foundation hopes to begin the program before the end of the school year. It's the first time they've run a program like this. But if successful, they hope to expand it to other rural schools. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
In California, plans to open a new gateway to Redwood State and National Parks got a big boost recently, paving the way for a parcel of land to be returned to the Yurok tribe. The place is called Oru on Highway 101, about 40 miles north of Eureka, at a former lumber mill site. Yurok Chairman Joseph James says this is a model for the land back movement.
It's not driven by Western society providing interpretation. Is being driven by Yuroks.
The area is closed for construction, but will reopen in 2026 as the Oru Redwoods Gateway with new trails, cultural signs, and visitor facilities. Redwoods National Park Superintendent Steve Metz says this is the first co-management agreement for tribally owned land with the National Park Service and California State Parks.
So this is just a recognition of their sovereignty, their need to regain land that was taken from them 2 years ago and turning it back and creating greater understanding about the original people in this area.
Future plans include a visitor center with a tribal village with plank houses and a sweat lodge. University of Arkansas Little Rock Assistant Director and Archivist of the Sequoia National Research Center, Erin Fair, is discussing Native American views on the solar eclipse. She's taking part in two speaking events this week ahead of Monday's total solar eclipse that will cross North America. Fair says with the more than 500 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., there are different beliefs regarding solar eclipses and traditional stories with cultural narratives that vary. She says this is a great opportunity to learn about stories, traditions, and perspectives. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Major freight railroads have to maintain two-person crews on most routes under a new federal rule that was finalized Tuesday. The Transportation Department's Federal Railroad Administration has been working on the plan for the past 2 years. There's been intense focus on railroad safety since a major derailment in eastern Ohio in 2023, but few significant changes have been made and a railroad safety bill proposed in response to the derailment stalled in Congress. Rail unions have long opposed one-person crews for a variety of reasons related to safety and job concerns. Labor agreements requiring two-person crews have been in place for three decades at major railroads. Eddie Hall, the president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen Union, said, "As trains, many carrying hazardous material, have grown longer, crews should not be getting smaller." He praised the FRA for taking the step President Biden had promised. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said, "Common sense tells us that large freight trains, some of which can be over 3 miles long, should have at least 2 crew members on board, and now there's a federal regulation in place to ensure trains are safely staffed. At least 11 states have already approved rules requiring 2-person crews. Some frustrated with the federal government's reluctance to pass new regulations on railroads have also tried to pass restrictions on train length. The railroad industry often challenges state rulings in court, but railroads generally argue in those state lawsuits that the federal government should be the only one to regulate the industry."
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Returning to local news, the Portland Art Museum's expansion and renovation will be open to the public by late 2025, this according to an announcement today. The expansion will add 95,000 square feet of newer upgraded public and gallery space. It's centered on the construction of a new Mark Rothko Pavilion that will be the new welcoming front door to the museum. The new glass pavilion will connect the two museum buildings, Main and Mark. The museum plans to have new, more intuitive pathways and increased visibility for its Native American and contemporary art collections. The Library and Research Center will move to the first floor of the Mark Building, and there will be a new cafe and expanded store. The museum has remained open during construction, and the timeline for completion has stayed consistent. The expansion was almost entirely privately funded, with a $111 million price tag, making it one of the most significant art investments in Oregon history.
An Illinois blizzard put a hyper-efficient home to the test. It passed. Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. When the power goes out on a cold winter night, some people head to a hotel. Others huddle around a fireplace, bundled up in hats and blankets. But after a blizzard knocked out the power at Katrine Klingenberg's home in Illinois, her house stayed warm and comfortable.
I was sitting in my living room in a t-shirt, and outside it was negative 40 wind chill, you know? And that's kind of cool.
She lives in a so-called passive house she designed herself. And she's co-founder of Passive House Institute US, a nonprofit that works to increase the adoption of passive house building standards. It's an approach that sets a very high bar for energy efficiency, focusing on a building's envelope. That includes the walls, roof, and windows, which protect against the outdoor elements. Passive houses are extremely airtight, with heavily insulated walls and high-performance windows. And in cold climates, they're designed to maximize the heat from the sun during the winter months.
Should the grid go out or grid fail, these buildings can coast through power outages for days, and you won't even feel it.
So she says they can help build people's resilience to extreme weather, which is growing more common as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
It is Wednesday, and that means a visit from our KBOO News poet, Dan Raphael, who wants a spring of new possibilities.
Yeah, all that sunshine was great, but I welcome the rain. For now, balance and variety are important, be it weather, diet, activity level. We definitely need more variety in politics. Let the rich lose once in a while, and by lose I mean pay a little closer to their fair share. Let the Supreme Court make a couple decisions based on what the law is, not what those five think the law should be. At least Netanyahu finally apologized for something. 7 aid workers killed, but still no tears for thousands of Palestinians murdered since October. There's so much cruelty and injustice, poverty and destruction of nature that we'll never be able to change immediately. Let's start with small steps, one-to-one kindnesses, whether specific or random. I need to practice tactfully questioning someone else's information. Where'd they get that? Maybe the U.S. can close a couple dozen bases in foreign countries. Maybe one day I'll check the news and you know whose name won't be there. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Yeah.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Frida Ross, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Pearl Stark, Mark Richardson, Mike Moen, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, live interviews coming your way shortly.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Back in the golden age of radio, there was a little known and short-lived network called Tesla Broadcasting Company, or TBC, founded in New York.